Okay, so thank you, Jim, for your insightful presentation. We're going to go to our two respondents. Initially, we were going to have three, but unfortunately, Bergman Fleury is not well today, so is unable to be here. So we're going to go to Professor Adele Blackett from McGill University and Cyriac Sumo from Interconexion Nord-Sud. And after that, we will have a chance for the audience to participate and to pose questions. Okay.
Well, first, allow me to extend my congratulations and deep thanks to the team of the Black Demographic Study report that I had the privilege to study, a report that's presented with great clarity, with an independence of scholarly analysis, and a precision that will render this an indispensable tool for future research on the black community in Montreal. Complementing the demographic data with the qualitative studies, which we'll learn more about this afternoon, will also provide insights that will make some of the policy implications more readily understood. I've been asked to respond to the study by focusing on the employment and incomes data presented in this material. And I'm conscious as well that having been born, educated, and now a working member of a Montreal black community, chiefly Anglophone and Caribbean in heritage, mais une communauté qui embrasse pleinement le caractère francophone et du Québec. I look at this data in context. These are not just statistics. These are the kids I played with when I grew up in LaSalle. These are the elders in the church communities that sustained its youth. These are the high school classmates who were also part of the enriched French programs, who moved away to Toronto, to major metropolitan areas in the United States, and farther afield, as soon as they completed their university degrees, lured by concrete job opportunities and the promise of joining a relatively stable black middle class community while continuing to work within the black communities that, in relative terms, and a finding brought forward in this study, seem to thrive elsewhere. These are the friends as well who, less bilingual, paradoxically, are less mobile, or may quite simply just have been less willing to leave their home here in Montreal, their communities here in Montreal, who stayed, and in many cases have struggled in and out of the Quebec labor market and sacrificed. I think about my largely francophone communities in the legal profession and some of my recently graduated black law students who share frustration that they do not receive, despite their educational levels, the same employment opportunities in the Montreal community, and as a result, when they are hired, face lower pay and much of the time work for their own account with the precarity that accompanies that. I think as well of the new highly educated Francophone colleagues, often from African countries, who struggle for recognition of their foreign diplomas and wonder whether they may not have been better off elsewhere, notably in jurisdictions with fewer self-regulated industries and fewer or lesser entry requirements. And here I note that Quebec has one of the highest numbers of self-regulated professions in Canada. I could go on, but what I wish to say in alluding to these experiences that many people in this room could share and could amplify, is that the survey analysis offers us a portrait, and the qualitative studies add color to that portrait. It is a picture of our community, a picture through which we may see ourselves reflected. We do not see our full selves. We cannot. It is a representation, one compelling representation, certainly not a flattering representation, but an honest representation, and one upon which we can build policy responses. The study's first contribution to our Black communities, and you will note that I deliberately use the notion of Black communities in the plural because of our diversity, right? There is a cohesion, but there is much diversity to be celebrated, but as the report also suggests, that poses organizational challenges. That our communities receive from this report a careful, statistically reliable analysis based on census data, which tests key hypotheses and captures the nature of labor market vulnerability. The second contribution is that it fills in the qualitative work that allows us to move forward. I'd like, in my short time, to focus on one key finding in the study, ably demonstrated in the preceding presentation, that one reason why members of Black communities earn less than non-Blacks is because we are overrepresented in low-paying occupations and underrepresented in higher-paying occupations. In sum, we face systemic inequality. We earn less not only overall, but within each occupational category. Yet our labor market participation for certainly the core category of 45 to 64 years of age is higher for Blacks than for non-Blacks. And in the 15 to 24 age category, the lower contribution rate is attributed to school attendance and post-secondary institutions at a high proportion. And if the point then about the disparity is not clear enough, the survey finds, in addition, in the very compelling graph 29, which was shown, that a Black university graduate has the same unemployment rate as a non-Black person who does not even hold a high school diploma. This is a deeply troubling set of findings, and they cry out for a policy response. One of the compelling elements of the study is that although it is very much present focused, it takes us back, right? It considers the historical causes for some of the disparities in over and under representation in categories. And in this regard, the study invokes the work of Dorothy Williams, a noted historian in our community, and echoes the work in Agnes Kellist's reports as well, surrounding one scheme in particular, which I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about, the domestic workers scheme, initially negotiated with the governments of Jamaica and Barbados in the 1950s, and then extended to other Caribbean states. The migration was of women, and the migration at the time was one of the first migration of non-white persons into Canada. So the women at the time immediately received their landing or permanent resident status as soon as they arrived in Canada. And the memorandum of agreement negotiated at the time very tellingly suggests that the Canadian government considered these women would naturally stay in domestic work, right? Hence the grant of permanent resident status. The other reason, also telling, was the suggestion that to do otherwise, to not grant them permanent resident status, would be akin to, or would certainly attract, charges of forced labor. Right? That, of course, practice or policy change. For as we know, the women who came had other ideas. They filled their service, but they cherished their freedom and their families, and in the economic environment of the time, found stable employment in public and parapublic sectors or in the burgeoning manufacturing sector at the time. Many, as we know, were trained nurses and quickly earned their training after their time in domestic work was over. Others, like the Honorable Jean Augustine, went on to earn their doctorates and to serve their adopted country in politics with distinction. But changes to the immigration regime then came, no longer allowed permanent resident status to attach directly on entry. And this not only, of course, meant lesser citizenship access, it meant family separation for prolonged periods of time, with the impact that we know for children who then came after not having seen their mother, in some cases, for a decade. Right. We should not be surprised that there are consequences on family structure, on life course for these second, in some cases third generations of our community to date. I raise this example as well because it is one of the reminders of the extent to which our labor market is segmented, certainly on the basis of race, but more generally on the basis of common sense understandings of what work is appropriately suited to what categories, what persons, what races. So just as the common sense, which interesting historically then changed, right, to such that the Filipina women became emblematic of domestic work. So periodicity matters. But a sense of the common sense of systemic inequality, who is meant to perform the more menial, the undervalued societal work, and who is meant to be society's leaders. And the common sense was most palpably borne out in, frankly, one of the worst decisions I have ever read in Quebec jurisprudence, a case entitled Centre Maraîcher Eugène Guinois, a 2005 Human Rights Tribunal decision about temporary agricultural labors from the Haitian community, not temporary migrants. These persons were actually permanent residents, and in one case, Canadian citizens. But persons who, and the literature surrounding this is remarkable, were simply understood to be fit for low paid, I mean, in this case, below statutory minimum wages, back-breaking labor beginning early in the morning, late at night, day employment, no employment stability, and on top of it, and ironically the reason it was a human rights case, because the equivalent of Jim Crow segregation conditions existed on this farm. Insalubrious bathroom facilities for these workers, denied access to kitchen facilities used by the white workers. The judge, Judge Posé of the Cour du Québec on the tribunal, who wrote the decision, began it by saying, this case occurred here in Quebec in 2001. That's how bad it was. But I underscore the case because although the Human Rights Commission had no difficulty challenging the segregation in terms of differential access to facilities, it seemed not to see the segmentation of the black community in agricultural, the manual, low-paid, back-breaking labor, whereas the more clerical or the more mechanized jobs were the exclusive terrain of the white workers. It was that blatant, but that's not what we addressed. And I would submit that this survey puts a finger on what we fail to see, or let me rephrase that, what the majority culture tends to fail to see about occupational discrimination. We can deal with the one case sometimes of abuse or harassment in the workplace, but we have tremendous difficulty dealing with the common sense of racism that relegates large percentages of our community to undervalued, underpaid labor and underrepresents us in higher paid, higher status positions, and this despite educational attainment. So this is structural inequality. To my mind, this is where our policy efforts need to turn themselves. I also think, and although I do not touch on the other aspects of the report, I do want to flag that we talk about racial profiling, and we're beginning through the hard work of governmental groups, of judges who have put helpful decisions forward to understand the notion of racial profiling in terms of the stigma attached to being, to having red onto one's body, right? Being a black person in society or a member of another racialized community in society, being read onto that dangerous in terms of police profiling or unfit in terms of profiling in terms of social services, educational contexts. The flip side to that in the workplace is being having read onto the body the one who should be doing the undervalued, low-paid work. Right? Race becomes a marker that ascribes place in society. So one of my former black law students shows up in a suit and a tie at the reception of a law firm where he has an interview and is told by the receptionist that the delivery pickup area is over there. Right? That's that phenomenon, and it's the barrier that stops access before one gets through the door, really, right? Before one gets past reception. Fonn Naimi's important qualitative study, which will be presented this afternoon, centers, I think appropriately, on recent measures, recent governmental initiatives at three governance levels, so the federal, provincial, municipal, to redress racial inequality in the workplace. The Commission des droits de la personne et des droits de la jeunesse last year, in a conference and then a recent publication on droit au travail sans discrimination, sets out a trajectory or possibilities for thinking, frankly, about and beyond the Bouchard-Taylor approach to accommodation and thinking about actually getting communities into the workplaces, right, as a concrete way to arrive at a deeper level of societal integration. Ultimately, I think, and I realize this is slightly early, right? Our study gives us an opportunity to start to canvas the policies that have been in place, what they have accomplished, and frankly, where they've let us down, right? And where we might move forward. And this is not the kind of discussion one can have in a few minutes, but I would like, nonetheless, to give some reflections on some of the challenges that have faced our traditional strategies. One of them is in respect of employment equity legislation. And as many know, in Quebec, we actually have mandatory legislation for public services. This legislation to date has meant quite significant reporting. The reports, by the way, are all on the Commission's website, and you can see the statistical details of how public institutions are doing on employment equity. Right? But there's a real question about whether employment equity as conceived or as interpreted or as implemented is really working for our communities, right? And again, the survey data has to look at a certain macro level, but read alongside these reports, you can see the portrait, right? And it's not encouraging. Part of the reimagining, then, is at one level simply to think about how we use the statistical data we have to identify what appropriate representation is. And so if what we're doing in employment equity legislation is saying, well, workforce participation should be similar in the public sector to what it is in terms of the private sector availability, are we actually establishing a higher threshold? Or are we just operating a self-referential system that doesn't actually increase the numbers of representation? Similarly, if our targets are so low as to mean that if your demographic numbers are small, we don't even see you, right? You can have no one in your institution, right? And we're only talking about large institutions in the employment equity context. But if we don't even see you because the number is too small, you actually have zero persons, but your required representation is, in fact, in percentage points, zero, then we haven't actually created a framework that is enabling for communities. I'm going to raise a slightly thornier dimension as well, because of how troubled I feel about the underrepresentation of the Black communities in particular. And here I note a slight sadness in respect of the report, because our communities are compared to the they're compared to the faceless non-Black communities, right? I don't know who they are. I really would like to know how we are doing in respect of the dominant culture, and also in comparison to other communities whose core is comprises immigrants or second or third generation communities, and certainly other racialized communities, right? To know where we stand. The data I have seen in the past, however, studies based on earlier census information, 2001 census, suggests we have not been doing well, even amongst other visible minority groups. And if that's the case, I think we need to think about measures that may be targeted specifically to our communities, right? Specifically to our communities in terms of employment access. Okay. So what do we need going forward? We certainly need then a serious rethinking of employment equity as it's understood, with a view to tightening and to the extent necessary, focusing on the needs of Black communities. We need complementary systemic studies of other measures. One of them that I'll just mention briefly out of concern for time, tell me how I'm doing here, but is in respect of incentives-based structures. We talk a little less about government procurements or measures that require contractors, business persons, who bid for government contracts of a certain amount to take on and report about employment equity measures. Right? These are ripe for tightening. These are ripe for greater attention. Studies as well of employers who are doing well on hiring, I think, are necessary in terms, and frankly, more of a spotlight on those employers as a way of providing incentives to other employers to consider positive, proactive measures. I also think there is a significant part of community potential. Community potential in two senses. One, to marshal more carefully our own purchasing power in support of those employers who do hire members of our communities and other racialized communities. If these are strategies, if these are policy conclusions that we want, I think we should be thinking about strategies that we want. And second, more attention to business ownership and similar forms of community self-employment or self-empowerment are critical. Finally, and I'd like to end here, because the slight anomaly, if you will, in the material presented was with respect to the educational and health sector, right? And so in that sector seemed to fare better, both in terms of representation by our communities vis-a-vis the non-black community, but also in terms of income data. And so certainly closer study as to why would be relevant, but the report already hints at something, and that is sectors with a stronger link to a regulatory framework that mandates conditions that are applied equitably across the board, right? So pay scales, right? Entry conditions, diploma-based, right, and recognition on the basis of those factors, clearer structures on promotion. I'll add that although unionization has not consistently, not always, been synonymous with equality for our communities, it warrants a good hard look at how the significant extent of unionization in this sector and the standardization of criteria that comes may at some levels affect the equity that applies. I say all of this with great caveats and the particular and anticipating Anne-Marie Livingstone's qualitative discussion of some of the serious challenges to approach, in particular in the education sector, to achieving transformative anti-racist strategies in education, which include representation by our communities. But I think this is a sector that warrants our attention. Okay. So my earlier examples then of labor market segmentation suggest that we not only need market opening opportunities, we also need to think about education and to think about it in terms of transformative education, not education that reasserts, that reaffirms the kind of hierarchy that is reflected in the report's core finding of overrepresentation in undervalued positions, underrepresentation in highly valued positions, but rather a transformative education that seeks to disrupt societal common sense and to help to position members of our communities differently, right? Position us to be able to claim our full citizenship, to recall Jim's closing remarks, in our communities. And so I underscore the report's conclusion in its statement of an emerging agenda that there is an urge, and I quote, that there is an urgency to intensify efforts to produce demonstrable improvements on the ground. And I hope that this discussion today and the many discussions that Dave Austin alluded to that are needed following this report, I hope that this will continue then to identify potential avenues. My key message is that the portrait painted in this survey resonates, right? And it sounds an alarm for policy interventions on many grounds, in particular in respect of occupation and employment. I believe, as our oft-quoted former Chief Justice of Canada stated, that work is fundamental. It's not simply a part of the way that one earns a livelihood. It's part of our identity. It's part of sociological, psychological well-being. It's part of our sense of belonging in the society. And so for our community, emphasizing employment access is a way of emphasizing our full citizenship in this society. Thank you.